Okay, good morning. So last time we discussed sort of what goes into building a discrete event simulation model, and we said we're in particular concentrating what's called an event advance model. Okay, and so the idea here is that your system state changes rapidly at certain points in time, instantaneously at certain points in time, and you have to track that evolution of state through these state changes, which are referred to as events, and obviously the characteristics of the events are significant. Is it an arrival, a departure? What exactly is it? And the timing of the events is important to us because we're going to be interested in system-related parameters, which are all critically dependent on that timing. So what our simulation model is going to do is allow us to build long traces, which are lists of events with timestamps attached. Okay. By examining these traces, we'll extract system parameters that we're interested in, and that's what we'll be talking about today. Well, the extraction will be one component, and then sort of the analysis, the making sense of what that input means will be another. Okay. In terms of our simulation model, we said the core of it was this event list, which is an ordered list of next events. So if you're in a certain state, you have a list of what can happen and, again, the time at which it can happen. Okay. And so you then have event logic, which says, well, one of those events is going to happen first, and what follows on from that event, what new events are instantiated. Okay. Timing is accounted for through the use of timers. And the cases we're interested in are these timers have, the values these timers take have some underlying statistical distribution. So we looked a bit at how we could generate sequences of values that appeared to be to have some distribution. We'll again return to the question of whether or not they actually or how well we can convince ourselves of that distribution in the next lecture. And for this lecture, what we want to do is think about what system quantities can we extract from our event lists, or some other way through our simulation model, and then how can we interpret the values we get. So we extract these parameters. How can we interpret the parameters? So that's what we'll be looking at today. And we have the same references as before. I'd say pretty much all of what's talked about today is in Harry Parros. Okay, so again, the purpose of setting up this model to begin with is to, in some way, represent the behavior of a system. And we might do that to try and predict the performance of a single system, or possibly to compare two alternative systems. whichever, you know, again, we're going to have to, you know, have some quantities, some metrics which we extract from our model and then make some sense of. If we observe a single run for our system, then that's one single possible behavior out of an infinite number of behaviors that we could have observed. Okay. And so what we're going to decide is that, well, a single behavior is not necessarily going to help us too much, but if we look at more than one, then we can say something. What we can do with a single behavior is measure some sort of system parameters. The ones that we'll look at today are the mean, so the average of something, the standard deviation, and then a little bit about maybe even estimating probability distributions or percentiles. Okay. So if you think about, for instance, building a model of a queue, then you're going to have this some sequence of mixes of arrivals and departures. And you know, you should be able to extract values like the average queue length or the average waiting time from a single observation. Okay. And so what we're going to, again, have to do is do that a number of times and then look at the results that we get. Okay. So our first task then is to look at extracting our parameters from our single trace. And we have to do that by sort of tracking variables within the system. Well, the obvious variable is the event itself. And typically we classify these variables as either exogenous or endogenous. And so exogenous variables are independent of other variables over the course of the run. And these are either the inputs to the system or possibly something internal to the system. Okay. So, if we look at our simple example, our queue, we would have our inter-arrival times and our service times. So we're setting those up, so it's not, you're not going to want to measure those later on because you've built them anyway. Your endogenous variables are the ones that are affected by these exogenous variables over the course of the simulation run. And so they can be internal or they can be output to the system. Okay, so for a queue, we can observe things like average waiting times, average queue lengths, etc. Okay, so these are the endogenous variables that we want to draw some conclusions about. Now, we observe that these are actually random variables. So, if we take a single run, a single trace, then we can measure the average waiting time over that trace. But if you think about the system as a whole, if we took a different trace, a different instantiation, you get a different waiting time, and so on. So these are stochastic processes at their core. The problem is that we don't have any way of really getting at the distribution. So we know that if each time we make a run, we're going to have a different observation, that all our observations have some underlying distribution, but we can't really tell what that distribution is. Okay. So that's why we have to be a little bit careful about how we interpret this data. Okay. So if I take a single run and observe the waiting time or the number of the jobs in the queue, I'm not going to be able to say a lot about how that reflects the overall system. Okay, so before we get into that, sort of how we interpret this sort of data, we'll just say a few words about how to measure the data. Again, it shouldn't be, there's nothing overly surprising. If we consider what we said about simulation models last time, at the very least, we have these traces that we're generating. Okay. So the arrival and departure of events with timestamps. Knowing that and knowing your event logic allows you to essentially measure any parameter within the system. And so one, the sort of most obvious thing to do is to just, store that date, that trace in a file somewhere, and then you can evaluate it later. Okay. So the plus of that, obviously, is that once you have that trace, if you can measure whatever you want. So, and if you think of something later on, well, you can just re-examine your file. You won't have to rerun your simulation. Okay. That obviously, that involves some overhead of in terms of storage, and then essentially you have to go back and do your analysis. It should be clear that you can always measure your data, or you can probably measure your data on the fly. So, with something internal to the program. And so in that case, you will define data structures within your model that are holding the parameters of interest. Okay. So you could have a linked list that indicates how long, at what duration of time you spend at any given queue length. And then you can just keep, you can just modify that sort of on the fly. Okay. So, as an example, if you want to measure waiting times, then, you can always, match arrival and departure pairs and together with the time between them, and that gives you the time that any given arrival waits. Just keep some sort of running tally on the time between arrivals and departures. Okay, so again, just looking at our queue example. Again, some of the things we want to look at are waiting times and queue lengths. In our simulation, we assume some sort of arrival and service disciplines and processes. So how long does it take to serve? What's the inter-arrival process look like? And let's assume we have, for the moment, a first-in, first-out discipline. Okay. So what we do with our simulation is we run that simulation for some fixed amount of time, t. And that, again, gives us a single sample behavior. And that sample behavior consists of arrival and departure events, which, again, are generating an arrival count and a departure count, and then obviously a queue length at any given time is the difference between the arrivals and departures. If it's first in, first out, then the waiting time is the wait between arrival and departure. Okay. So, again, what we're asking, for the moment, we're thinking about asking questions about system averages. So for that trace, we can define our system average. So our average waiting time is just the sum of the waiting times for each arrival. Okay. And divided by the number of arrivals overall. So you could extract this information from an examination of the trace, or you can keep a running tally of waiting times and the number of arrival events and divide those two numbers. Okay. The average queue length is a little more complicated in the sense that it can change at any point in time. So you take a time average, so you integrate under the curve of the count, and then divide by the total amount of time taken. So, again, how would you want to count this? Well, the easiest thing to do is to observe, but essentially we have a bunch of rectangles sitting on each other, so you can sort of easily calculate the area under the curve. Okay. And so if we look at the time between arrivals and departures, that'll give us a duration sort of at a certain number.
And again, you can keep that as a running tally.
Okay. So, again, we can always, if we've kept our traces, we can always examine that trace. But, yeah, there are complications in that you do have to be careful that you're actually assessing the correct quantity. For instance, if you have your values are going to change, your waiting times for per arrival will change depending if you have a last in, first out, or a first in, first out system. Okay. And so, we can also, again, try to look at time differentials. Okay. And then the counts, the end values at any given time. That will allow us to give our queue lengths, average queue lengths. Okay, so the bottom line here is that, again, if you save your trace, then you should be able to examine, extract all these values given the trace, sort of later on. But it's also possible to gather your data within the running of the simulation, which we'll see. There's two reasons for that. It can be easier, and also we'll see that one issue is determining when you're in steady state, and you'll have to do some sort of on-the-fly calculations to determine steady state.
Sorry, can I just ask, packet lengths have a mean of 8,000 bits. Mm-hmm. Does that mean that the processing time for each packet is purely arrival at the part? So if there's a slot available for it, you just push it on to it's like the code, you hold the queue or whatever, and it moves on, and then the next packet comes back in. Do we do anything with the packets because they're going to be a variable size?
Variable size translates to a variable service time.
Okay.
So you have a fixed transmission rate.
Yeah.
So depending on the size of the packet,
yeah,
your transmission time will be, your departure time will be smaller or larger.
Okay.
So that's where the variable size enters into it.
And just a second question of that, would you have to use a separate random number generator generate those packet sizes, or could you use the same one that you've used for your clocks, your arrival?
No, you can use the same sequence, just pull the next number and the next number and the next number. So you can use one sequence of random numbers.
Yeah.
Again, that depends on distributions. But, okay. So, again, I've already said this, export to a file or save values within your program and try and do running tallies. Okay, and so the values we're going to look at are averages, means, variances, percentiles, and then sort of probability distributions. So measuring means and variances is, you know, again, this idea of just examining the trace and calculating those values. Percentiles is slightly different. A percentile asks the question, sort of, how many, what's the value sort of experienced by, what's the maximum value, is there value in an ordered sense experienced by a certain portion of the population. Okay. So if, you know, you do an exam and you are told you're in the 95th percentile, that means that you're better than 95% of the, you've got a better mark than 95% of the population. Okay. So, to answer a question like that, well, you have to just observe a great enough number. Okay, so again, if we ask, for instance, the question of what's the maximum waiting time experienced by 95% of our arrivals, then we track the waiting times of all our arrivals. We have to order them, so that could be a pain. And then we look at what value gives us 95% of them. Okay. So the easiest thing is if we had 100 observations, then we'd just go to the 95th one in the ordering. So, in a similar way, we could look at, say, intervals, how many, you know, percentages of populations that fall within certain intervals, and we can use that to build up something like a histogram for the distribution. Now, what we've done so far is sort of gone through the mechanics of extracting a number from our simulation model. And again, we've noted that that number is... it's an instance of a random variable. Okay, so there's some underlying distribution on that number. Okay, so we've looked at the average waiting. Yeah, if we look at our Q example, we looked at average waiting times, Q lengths, percentile values. The value we get out, again, is an instance of a random variable. Okay. If we run our simulation with a different starting point, a different seed for our random number generators, then we are going to get a different value. Okay. So, within a given trace, our observations of quantity are not independent. So if we observe a sequence of waiting times, then if you have a high waiting time at a certain point, that indicates that your queue is congested. It's not going to change for the, it's probably not going to change for the next arrival. So the next arrival will also come to a congested queue, most likely. So within any single trace, the observations are not independent. But if we have multiple traces that start from a random point, then we say that our estimates, these averages, are independent for each trace, we hope. We'll say more about that later. So we're going to start looking at the case of trying to estimate a system average, because again, this is one where for our various traces the observations are independent per run. And so we'll see how we can use multiple runs to estimate our system average. Our system, which is a given system parameter. Okay. So the idea is we're going to use multiple runs to come up with a system, an estimate of the overall system parameter. And then the key concept that we'll have is what's called a confidence interval. And that's going to be a measure of how close our estimate is to the real parameter. Okay, so this real, we have this underlying distribution that we know nothing about, or it's very complicated, so we can't say anything about it. But we can observe it again and again and again for the different traces. And if we have enough observations, enough traces, then we'll be able to say something about how close it is as an estimate. Okay. So when we're doing this, we're assuming that our system is in steady state. So essentially, when we observe these values, they're not going to change with time. Okay. And so, as we discussed for our Markov processes and then our queues, typically a system has two phases. It starts out in a transient phase. So if you have a queue, it starts out with nobody in the queue. And as time goes on, you have arrivals, and eventually you reach a point where your when you look at queue length, you're cycling around the average queue length. Okay, so that's when we've reached that point, again, where you're cycling around that average, so where you started is no longer important, then that's when you've reached steady state. So the parameters that we're estimating are steady state parameters. Okay, so it just assumes that such things exist to begin with, and that we can capture them. Okay. So for our purposes, we're not going to be too concerned with the transient behavior of a system. It can be of interest, but that's not what we want to examine here. We want to look at our steady state parameters. So somehow you have to account for the transients in your simulation model. Okay. And so you have to decide something, determine some way that you're in, that you've reached steady state, and you can try just trying various lengths of simulations, and the longer and longer you get, compile statistics for each, and you know, stop or decide, choose your Q length when you observe that the statistics aren't changing a whole lot. Typically, what you might do that on the fly, and so you assume that you've reached steady state when your system parameters aren't changing significantly. Okay. So we have some handle on then how long our simulation needs to be. We still have this transient phase, and so there's two things we can do with it. Well, we can start collecting our, if we've decided sometime T after which it's reached steady state, we can start collecting the data only after T, or again, if you have this value T, then you can run your simulation for a significantly longer period of time, so that again, this steady the transient phase is only a very small portion of the data, and is not sort of impacting the data overall. Okay. So from now on, we're going to assume that we are in steady state, that the data, that the estimators that we gather are estimators in the steady state. We want to estimate system parameters like means, variances, or possibly percentiles. And so again, there's, you know, for the whole system as a whole, there's a single value. Okay. And if you think about Q length, there is an average, there's a mean Q length. Okay, well, assume that's MM1, so it's exponentially distributed. We can actually analytically come up with a single number for the Q length. Okay. What we're doing here is we're looking at a trace. It's not an infinite trace, it's a finite trace. And we're going to, again, observe our value for that single trace. But then we're going to do this over and over and over again. And we're going to use multiple values, multiple observed values, to produce an estimator for our system parameter. So we go from the actual value, which in most cases we just won't know, to an estimator, so actual value theta to an estimator theta hat. So, and if we were looking at something like waiting times, we can compute the average waiting time for each run. Then just, if you have 50 runs, you just average over the 50 runs. We're going to need, we're going to use properties of those multiple runs to allow us to generate our confidence interval. Okay. So, again, for each run, what we observe is a random variable. And so if we have n observations, we assume that they're independent and identically distributed. Okay. And so for each of these, we assume there's some mean and some variance. We don't know overall what that mean and variance is, but we can come up with an estimator for it by taking multiple observations. And so if we want to estimate our mean, we just take the sample mean. So we calculate it for each observation, and then just average them. If we want to do NTR at our first, for our first crack at it, we're going to do the same for variance. So we're just going to say the variance is just the average calculated variance. Okay. So, excuse me. What we'd like is for our estimates to be unbiased. And bias is the expectation of our estimate minus the actual system parameter. Okay. So if you have an estimate of a system parameter, you would hope that at least its expectation, its mean value, was the system mean. Similarly for variance, you'd hope that the average value of the variance was the system variance. Okay. This still doesn't mean that you arrive at exactly that value. Your observed values are going to be cycling, you know, around that value. Okay. So, excuse me. We had our estimator for the system mean, X bar, and we can argue that X bar is unbiased. But what we're going to see is that our original cut at estimator for variance actually is biased. And or that's the for sigma squared, the moment is biased, and that we actually, instead of doing 1 over n, we need to do 1 over n minus 1. Okay. So we can see this directly. We have our, if we have our x bar is 1 over the sum of xi's, then its expectation is the expectation of the quantity. It's a finite sum, so you can move the expectation inside to take the expectations of each xi. Obviously, the expectation of xi is mu, so you have 1 over n and mu, and so you get mu overall. Okay, so that gives us some comfort that, you know, our estimator for mean is not an unreasonable one. Okay. If we try to do the same thing for the estimator of sigma squared, we're actually going to see that we do have a bias. Okay, so we see that by expanding our xi minus x bar squared. We take off the mean. So that's, you know, what we're going to do with that is get sigma squared terms. And so if we then expand out that term, and we can look at each of the components in turn. And so we have this first component is our estimator. And then we have additional components here for which if you pull the expectation in, so you have the expectation of x bar squared. Minus mu, and so this term gives us sigma squared, and then minus expected value of x bar minus mu squared, and that's going to be less than a sigma squared, so our value is actually going to be less than our actual system parameter. So we make a second attempt. We have our system parameter is now 1 over n from 1 over n to 1 over n minus 1. And so we can pull the n minus 1 out and then examine, again, each of our components in turn. So our first component, since these are IID, you get n, expected value of x I squared, second component, you get the expectation of x bar, and then pulling our sum in, summation I equals 1 of the xi's, and then n expected value x bar squared. Okay, so, and you can work that down to n expected value of xi squared minus an expected value of x bar squared. So our expected value of xi squared is going to be sigma squared plus mu squared, so that's by the definition of variance, and similarly our expected value of x bar squared is sigma bar squared plus mu bar squared. Okay, whoops, you moved the n over. Okay. So we now have to look at trying to evaluate our sigma bar squared and our mu, our sigma bar and our mu bar. And in order to do that, we appeal to the central limit theorem. Okay. And the central limit theorem is a very handy result, which says if you have a number of IID random variables and you sum them and divide by whatever number you have, then as n gets large, I see there's a few typos here, but as n gets large, then this sum or sample average is what you're really doing, approaches a normal distribution with the mean being the system mean and the variance being, or the sigma squared, estimate being sigma squared over n. Okay, so the variance is actually shrinking. Okay. So if we use that result, then our sigma bar squared becomes sigma squared over n, and our mu bar squared becomes mu squared. Okay. And if you, again, just work that out, you're going to get an n minus 1 over n times sigma squared plus mu squared. Times sigma squared, and which will give us that our expected value now of our sample sigma squared is sigma squared. Okay, so a fair amount of work, which in the end gives us that we actually have our an unbiased estimate. So again, there's a couple of typos here, but I'll fix those and redo the notes and repost the slides. Okay. So all that work, what we've done is we've come up with a couple proposed estimates for mean and variance. And now we want to do some work to examine how we can use these estimates. We're going to start off looking at that means specifically, because there's a slight complication with variances. So we have an estimator. So we've taken our mean, we've averaged, we've taken a mean for a number of traces. We've then averaged those over the number of traces. And what we'd like to ask is, how close is that sample average mean to the actual system mean? We know that in an expectation sense, it's equal, so you'd expect it to be sort of cycling around, but you know, how far away can it get? Okay. We answer, again, that question by constructing what's called a confidence interval. A confidence interval is going to say, well, you're likely between a certain spread and that has to be paired with a confidence level. The confidence level is saying, well, what does likely mean? Okay. So your confidence level will be given as a percentage. And so, and then that's paired with our interval. And the interpretation of that, if we, when we construct this, the interpretation will be that our sample average mean, or whatever parameter estimate, will be in an interval around sigma, within the confidence interval around sigma, or conversely, sigma, our mean, is going to be in the confidence interval around our estimate, 95% of the time. Okay. So what we'd like is that that interval is fairly small, so tight, and that means that most of the time the sample mean average that we take is going to be fairly close to the actual system value. Okay. And so typical confidence levels are 90, 95, 99%. So if you have a 99% confidence level, that means that 99 times out of 100, what you observe is actually close to the system value. Okay. So how do we decide that? Well, again, we use our central limit theorem to decide that. And so we have a number of IID random variables. So in this case, this is going to be our mean that we calculate for each trace. And we, our sample average, our sample mean value then is estimated by 1 over n times the sum. So you take the average over all of the traces. Okay. And what we already said was, again, this is approaching a normal distribution, and our standard deviation, our variance around the mean, is becoming small. So as n increases, you're getting tighter and tighter to the mean. Okay. So we can look at that here. And so just if we look at different values of n from 1 to 32, what we see is sort of the greater the value of n, the more you're getting that normal shape, but also the tighter it is becoming around our average value. And so, again, our system average is going to be the average value, and the variance around it is governed by the shape of this curve. The more observations we take, the skinnier this curve gets. And so the more likely you are, again, to be close to any given value. So normal distributions are, it's complex to evaluate values, but it's done in general. There are tables expressing these values and expressing the amount, the percentage of a population that falls in any interval around the mean. And typically this is done as a multiple on the standard deviation. So if you're one standard deviation away from the mean, plus or minus, then you encompass roughly 68% of the population. You take another standard deviation and you encompass about 95% of the population and so on. Okay. So, again, what we're going to have to determine is, what's the size of that interval, given we're looking for a particular percentage to catch a particular percentage of that, of the population. So, here, again, if we wanted to catch 95% of the population, we'd roughly want to be plus or minus 2 standard deviations. Okay. So this information in general is given in tabular form. So in this case, what this table gives you is one side of that curve, so and then a value as a multiple of a standard, of the standard deviation. So again, if you looked at one standard deviation, you'd reach this point in the curve, which again is the 34.1%. Again, we're looking for 95%, so over both sides of the mean, which translates to 47.5% over the single side of the mean, which is 40.475 in our table, and that's 1.96 standard deviations from the mean. Okay. So if we want to ask this question, so we have 95% confidence level. We're going to, the corresponding confidence interval is going to be our mean plus or minus 1.96 standard deviations. Okay. So, again, we have our sample average mean, and then if we have enough samples, so typically we would say, as a rule of thumb, 30 is around 30 samples, we say, is you're going to get your normal distribution, then the distribution of our estimator is normal. Okay. And so if we then estimate our standard deviations, and we have our estimate of our average, then we can find the confidence interval. Okay, so we can find how likely that estimate is to be close to the system average. Okay. So if we knew sigma, our system the standard deviation for the system, then we'd be all right, but we don't. So we use our estimator for sigma and
assume that that's going to be close. Okay. So then
our confidence interval is since we have 95%, our multiplier is the 1.96. Sigma is given by S over square root of N. And then again, we're plus or minus
around our sample mean.
Okay. Clearly, the greater N is, the smaller your interval is going to be, so the better your estimate.
Okay, so obviously
you could still get unlucky. You could still fall if your interval is 95%, then you could still, the actual parameter value could still fall outside of our confidence interval, but again, it's becoming less and less likely. And again, also the probability of falling any distance outside of that interval is, the farther out you are, the less likely it is. Okay, so that gives you some measure or comfort with your estimate, and it gives you numbers to sort of pin down how comfortable you are with your estimate. Okay, so that's really the key idea for today, is this idea of confidence intervals, so being able to say again being able to estimate our system parameter and then determine, in some way quantify how comfortable we are with that estimate. So I think I'll take a break now, and we'll just look at sort of a few, we'll look at variations. We'll look at variations on this calculation. We'll look at, that's one. We've discussed this for one parameter, the system mean. We'll look at it again for percentiles and variances. And we'll talk a little bit more about actually gathering those samples. So, again, it's a good time to take a break and sort of ponder that, and we'll meet back here in, the usual 15 or 20 minutes.